You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Did you know that cannibals refer to humans as long pig?
Yes, I did know that.
I have so many questions.
Back why when do you know this? Cannibal cult.
Because yeah, it's like, why is this at the ready for you?
Because every time you drive through Donner Pass, you have to think about what happened at the Donner, yeah, at Donner Pass.
I actually have driven through Donner Pass a lot, and I've never had to think about that.
You don't think
it
about
like
the Donners eating each other?
They let me go through Donner Pass without having to think of that.
My mind won't let me. I gotta go there. And so one time I was like, is
do you
this
like
really
look
a
around
thing?
Like, do you think that's where they barbecued up that guy?
Or yeah, like, I wonder all of it. Yeah.
What?
Man.
It's crazy to think about. That. And so I like when I
just
deep dive one
cold
time
the Google lake it. Is. That's all I think of. I don't think of that. What's it like to live in your head, Brandon?
It's horrible. You guys
do you think we'd survive a day in your brain?
I think you would, but I think if you got
I
into my brain,
I don't think we would.
I think you would be so impressed. not with my brain. I think you'd be so impressed with how well I function. Given
what's in your brain.
Okay.
It'd be similar to like you going into like a hoarder's house and you're like, wow. I'm impressed that you live here. You just read the paper over in that pile of trash? That's incredible. I think that's what it'd be like.
That would be an amazing podcast episode. Just the three of us inside Brandon's brain.
Inside Brandon's brain, bopping around.
Be like Magic School Bus.
Oh, gosh.
Seeing out through his eyes and hearing what he's hearing and saying without being able to do anything about it.
That would be terrifying.
Would you do that if you had the opportunity?
Yes.
I would not.
You wouldn't?
I don't think I would.
Wow.
I don't want to know.
I'm pretty big on like not wanting to know what's going on in people's minds.
Oh. Really?
I don't think I want that power.
I do.
You do? See, I think it's too much.
Just for like a little bit. And then you get out.
I like the mystery of it. It'd be too much. Particularly your brain, Brandon. I think all those that you described it actually is probably true. I'd go through the cycles of grief. I'd be very sad. All this happening. But then I'd end up being, I think, very impressed. But he's a functioning adult and he does it, you know?
Oh, man.
But I think that's true of all of us. I think all of us would get in their brains.
You think we'd be traumatized by your brain?
Yeah. I think so. I think we would, right? Because it's like what you don't, it's not your baseline. Like, all of us have, like, a different way, like...
In your
that's
head,
what I was
getting
at, like, earlier with marriage, like, I didn't realize I was folding towels wrong. Like, that's just a whole different mode. And imagine that for everything. You know what I mean?
We in your head, I just picture it would be a lot of white.
Cream undertones.
Eggshell. That's Matt.
Yeah.
I pictured...
Why white, by the way?
I just feel like it would look like an Apple commercial.
No way. I'm thinking a beehive. You're just surrounded by a bunch of objects whizzing around at a million miles an hour. Countless. Sometimes they form into cohesive thoughts. Like really, really cohesive thoughts. And then they disintegrate again and join the hive.
It's like that scene in Inside Out when they go into like the abstract land and everything's white. And it's all like crazy and flattened and people don't know how to operate. Yeah,
that's a brilliant part of that movie.
That whole movie's brilliant. It's so good. Number two's coming out.
Okay, I actually wanted to ask you guys a serious question that you're gonna have to think about for a bit. But given the illustration that Kevin talked about, so you told the whole analogy of when Maddie rode her bike. Does she know you said that? I know she listened to this podcast. Does she know you used that story?
Yes, I will not use the story of my girls without their permission.
You good?
Yeah. So I asked her.
So she got to a point where she was like, "I am not the kind of person that should ride a bike or would ride a bike." And she started, you saw her kind of starting to believe that lie when she gave up. And my question is, do any of you have anything in your memory where you have had something like that, where there's been a lie that you have believed?
I can think of one. And so I have this theory as to why I'm still in school. And some of it is because I enjoy the life of the mind and study and all that sort of thing. So there's certainly that part. But I think there is something to, like, I remember as a kid, I was always the church kid. Like, that was just part of my identity. And sometimes that was great. I actually was relatively uncomfortable with that, but it was never uncomfortable to the point of, like, throwing it out. Like, it never, like, it was just, I've always had, like, that's who I am. Like, it's who my family's been, and that's what we do. So, like, I've never struggled with the existence of God, for instance. Like, that's always been just I have no problem just taking that presupposition, being like, yeah, it's God exists, and therefore, da-da-da-da. So that's kind of there. And so I've always had this thought of, like, but yet being kind of the outside kid, the church kid or whatever it was, always on the outside looking in, I have this thought that, like, half the reason I'm still in school is I'm trying to, like, work out, like, the rationality of God, of, like, if I can just prove that I can be smart enough for God to exist or whatnot, or I can prove it to these people, I'll fit in, I'll be more comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And so it's somewhere in that kind of vein of, like, I don't know if it's a lie I'm believing, but a mental map I can be stuck in sometimes. And I think it roots down towards a sort of trying to prove myself in different avenues, right? Whether it's social acceptability or prove to myself that I'm smart enough or whatever it is. But, like, there can be those sorts of lies that probably are down there deeper behind that idea. But
yeah,
I don't know if that.
So that the idea that, like, I don't know if you and I grew up in, I think there are probably similarities to how you and I grew up in faith, but
most people that encounter us think we grew up in the same house. they assume we're either the same person or related. Aren't you guys
brothers or twins? but the idea that you have to kind of set aside your intellect, like, that that was kind of a thing. Like, mm-hmm. no one would have ever said it that explicitly, mm-hmm. but, like, you're kind of encouraged to, there are certain things that you're encouraged to not really. Yeah. Don't go down that road, you know, especially around doubt. Like, if your intellect brings you to a place of doubt, like, it really felt wrong.
Yeah.
You weren't allowed to do that.
Yeah. So. And I think it's because there was, that's really, I think that's better language than I was trying to articulate. But it's that, like, reduction of faith again to thinking opposed to, like a whole life orientation. Like, faith felt like that blind leap. I think I talked a little bit about that on Sunday. Like, it has to be just this almost willy-nilly acceptance of whatever. And I just remember, like, as a kid or in middle school, high school, like, that idea that my friends would almost, like, laugh off of, like, when you still believe in these sorts of fairy tale type things.
Yeah.
And so I always wrestled with that sense of, man, I feel like there's a rich tradition of an intellectually kind of rigorous belief in faith. And not that that's all there is, but I think that's part of what I was chasing, was that I wanted to reject that I had to, you know, leave my brain behind or be thoughtful in that.
What about you, Rach?
I feel like I live a lot in my head, so it's hard to pick, like, one example, but oftentimes I'll have family or friends point out what's true versus what's real. Mm. Most times it's, like, false beliefs about myself or friendships or relationships, like, this person hates me. They're like, why do you think that? I'm like, because they looked at me this way. They're like, they just looked that way because that's something's going on in their world. It doesn't always revolve around you. But
imagine if that person really did, like, vehemently hate you. Like, every time you looked at them, they were just like, oh, see, Rachel.
That's the exact reason I don't want to know what's in people's minds. I'd rather buy the delusion that they're putting on for me.
The odds that someone, like, super hates Rachel, though, I mean, it's gotta be low. The people on earth that hate you, Rachel, it's gotta be a low compared to all of us in the room. There's gotta be people that hate us, but
yeah. But that's a good example, though, I think, of where that kind of belief lie plays out, as I think it does in those little areas too, of we misinterpret a situation and then we get in our head and it plays to our insecurities or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it bubbles up into something much larger. And it's good to have those people around you who remind you of that.
Yeah.
Nah, that's not true. That's a lie. Whatever it is.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, Nico.
What's your middle name, Nico? I wanted to call you your middle name right there.
Have we not discussed it yet?
Theodore.
Nicholas.
No. Oh, God, no.
I feel like
what's it start with?
I think it's going to be Slavic.
What letter does it start
with? No, it starts with an A.
Oh.
Anthony.
Nope.
Is it Nicholas too? Nicholas?
Mm-hmm.
Is that your full name? Nicholas.
Alexander.
Nope. Ooh, that was good though. Dang.
We have talked about this.
Have we?
I feel like once in like a staff meeting or
Nicholas,
something.
Nicholas, Arkansas.
Argyle.
No. No.
Anyway, go ahead, Nicholas Andrew.
How
did I get it? Oh, right? Yes! Oh.
That was so nonchalant.
Kevin's on CPC Connect.
Yeah, I'm not a problem. I figured it out.
That means your yes. initials are nah.
Nah. Yep.
I have a little monogrammed box in my room. It just says nah.
NH. Oh.
It took a little bit, but then I recalled a lie that I've struggled with since high school, probably. And it was a lie that I can't be disciplined. Like, I'm not the kind of person that is capable of discipline.
Mm.
Mostly with regards to academics, but then I found it expressing itself also in things like missed deadlines or being late to meetings or other get-togethers. And that, I guess, is a surprisingly hard one to tackle because it's a little subtle. And there's truth to the fact that if you repeat a lie often enough, it starts to sound like a truth.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually took a second for me to even think back and say, yeah, okay, that is a lie that has been, that I've noticed since high school, probably. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating how, like, and it's fascinating where we go after that, like after the lie, like what is your relationship with that person and how do you avoid them or talk to them because you think they hate you, Rachel or Nico? Like, what do you do then as a person? If you start believing that lie, do you just stop trying or do you say, well, I guess I'm going to keep trying to be an undisciplined person in a disciplined world? Or, you know, I just think about that. It's so interesting. The most recent one I can think of that I actually was unpacking with a therapist a little bit is that artists are, it's not a real job. It's not like a real, like, worthwhile, you know, profession or career or whatever. And so I've always really struggled. And you know, I'm not an artist for my career. But I think one of the reasons why I never really fully pursued it was because of that notion. Because, you know, like when you hear about, you know, a banker or an electrician or, you know, whatever, there's like finite things. And for whatever reason, that is in my brain, probably for a lot of, I can think of a lot of different reasons why that would be in my brain.
Yeah.
Maybe you're going to make some astute observation on all of this, Kevin. That's what I was hoping for, but you didn't. You didn't. So
I'm letting you lead, Brandon.
How do we work out those lies and work in?
Boom. There's an astute question.
Are most of those kind of tied to identity, would you say? What we just heard, the sampling, some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, probably in some way, shape, or form. Yeah, I would think, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking a lot about, like, identity is so important to understand, like, who we are and understand, like, where we live from. But there's a tension between, like, I was, throughout the sermon, I kept feeling this tension of trying to not also preach in a way that says, if you believe the right thing, then your life will follow. Because, like, as we've been unpacking for quite some time, we are more than just our beliefs, our intellect. It isn't that one just naturally flows from right belief equals right living. It has to do far more with, like, loves and longings. And so those sorts of things that we just identified go deeper than just what I believe is true about myself or not true about myself. And it has to begin to shape, like, your loves and longings kinds of things. Like, it has to get deeper than just, like, intellectually, I know this thing, right? And maybe a good example is, you know, as someone who grew up, again, in the church, always been in the church, I had known the information of Jesus for my whole life. Like, I always knew the stories and always knew the right answers and all those sorts of things. But that didn't produce in me a sort of life of the disciple of Jesus until I started coming to face with my own sinfulness, the reality of something like grace, or as Paul's talking about in Colossians, like the reality of Jesus as that center. Like, it has to move beyond just intellect, but yet at the same time, like, what we believe about ourselves does impact action too, and it does lead towards a different self-confidence and understanding of the self in connection to like the greater life. Like, Maddie needed to know that she was in fact capable of riding that bike. She needed to know that she was brave and can do hard things, but it was more than just the intellect. Like, in some ways she, I think, intellectually knew that, but it was, how does that move from kind of the brain to actually like her hopping on that bike again and moving her forward? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So the role of information has an important place. It isn't the only thing though, either. Like, we can buy that myth that we are only what we think. But that's not entirely true. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. The all of Colossians 2 kind of seems to be, correct me if I'm wrong, because you didn't take it literally in this direction, but it seems to be sort of an indictment on religion, or at least an indictment on making religion like an identity setting.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite say that all of Colossians is that. I mean all of Colossians is...
The verses you read.
Yeah, certainly chapter 2. Yeah. It delves into that. But I think it's important to put it in the context of that first century debate that was going on. It's hard. I was really sitting in that this week of how profound of a change it was in human history to have the faith, like to have religion expand beyond one's ethnic background, right? Or ethnic people, if you will. Like, that was radically, I mean, when Paul starts preaching the gospel to the Gentiles, like, we hear that as or maybe we don't, but that is a debate that most people are familiar with of like, well, that's different. But I think it's hard for us to really imagine how radically new that was to move that beyond Judaism to those who were Gentiles. And so you have to place it kind of in that context and the radical shift that was. And so it adds to what we understand about like how much that debate was raging on, do those Colossians, those Gentiles have to become Jewish before they become Christian? And in that, that's downstream from the question that you were just talking about, Brandon, which is part and parcel to chapter 2, is the debate was, yes, they do. And so therefore they have to go through the quote works of the law, which is the phrase that is used often in, I mean, all over Galatians, all of Galatians was essentially written to that particular issue. And so it isn't, it's like, and where I was trying to hit it was that sort of external marking versus internal marking.
Yeah, yeah.
And that idea that religion is an external thing in which you can find your identity. And for the Jews, that was a very real reality. They were finding their identity through circumcision, through a practice like Sabbath. Like, that was the identity marker. It's what made those people different and distinct from among the others. But of course, the shift for the Gentiles, they didn't necessarily have those things. They didn't have circumcision. So what then do you do with that? And that's that radical shift. And so it is religion, but it's religion, at least in a particular context. But we certainly can map that onto like a modern example where
that's exactly what I was going to ask you. Where does that show up? Like, today, what types of things? I mean, when you say, you know, getting our validation from external measures, certainly we have external things, but like, how would you, what do you see maybe as a pastor and person who kind of studies culture?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's where I landed this sermon was on those, I think the three primary areas we do. And because the issue is fundamentally different, because we would be, you know, we're Gentiles. I don't think anyone's Jewish in here. So we're like in this room, we're literally Gentiles. So we're not, you know, in the Jewish lineage. And at the same time though, like, we aren't living in a Jewish culture either. We're in a very Gentile context, which is different than Paul's writing. So we have to do that work of how do we bridge from where Paul's at to where we are. But at the same time, none of us are necessarily tempted to become Jewish to follow Jesus, right? Like, that's not our default setting. And so that poses different challenges. But yet that impulse of finding external things to help bridge or to find that reconciliation, right? Like, is certainly there. And this is where we got to hold what Paul's doing from chapter one into chapter two. Chapter one, he's making that statement that we are all, the fundamental human problem is alienation. We all feel that, Christian or non-Christian. We feel something's wrong. And then the human pursuit is essentially trying to overcome that alienation. And so we can do that through a thousand different ways. These are what you could call idols. These are what you could map downstream of this is the concept of sin, of things we're finding other than Christ. And so then the question is, what in our modern world do we run to bridge that alienation? And maybe in the broadest sense, you know, the three that I honed in on was like, you are what you accomplish, right? Which I think in a capitalist society, that's so the air we breathe that you put in 8 hours work, you get 8 hours wages, which I'm not even saying that's a bad system. But what I'm saying is that is so ingrained in us that we believe what we accomplish is where we find value. And really even from there, it's like what economic output you produce, that's where you have value. Like that's a very logical trend to then place. Why do we celebrate and esteem the rich and the powerful? It's because they're the best at that game, right? Like that's a very logical progression. And again, I'm not even necessarily down on that. I'm just saying that's in our DNA. And so what comes from that is, of course, if I can't accomplish much, I must be of little value. Or if I accomplish everything, I'm of great value.
Which is maybe why I don't believe that artists are taken seriously.
Yeah.
Because the vast majority of artists are not going to be like economically prosperous because of their art.
Mm-hmm. Well, even look at the way our school systems have changed towards a STEM model, which isn't bad. We need, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Like those are important things and really important fields. But we've made that shift at the diminishment of the humanities, which is a move that says they're more important than the humanities. And I would argue like a world that without the humanities has a hard time understanding something like beauty, something like art, like all those sorts of things that allow us to filter and view reality differently than a sort of mechanical sense. You know, I think in some ways that I think this contributes a little bit to like the tension and the polarization we're in is because we look at life through a very mechanical lens. And AI we've lost the ability.
AI certainly isn't helping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not going to help in all those things. And so it's, we've lost the ability to like, we need poets. We need, you know, prophets. We need artists. We need those because they help us to filter and understand reality. And we need engineers and mathematicians and all those sorts of things. But I think it's a great example, Brandon, of that the reality is the, you know, the English professor or the English degree probably isn't as economically viable as something like engineering. Mm. And so it's demonstrating that sense of loss or whatnot, or value on what you accomplish or produce.
Do you think our actual religion, like our going to church, our, you know, the practices of our faith could actually be something that we cling a little too tightly to?
I think that's a little, you know, in that sermon, I was trying to be a little vulnerable and just show that, like, no doubt I've done that as pastoring, you know what I mean? Where it's like, I do the spiritual things for a living, you know what I mean? And so no doubt that can turn into a means of how I view my value. Is not just named as a beloved child of God, but as someone who Sabbaths regularly and has a daily practice of silence and reads the scriptures and, you know, all those kinds of things that, again, I would argue are relatively neutral, although that might be a little bit too casual to, like, both in the workplace and in the kind of, quote, Jesus things that we're talking about. But they can certainly usurp the kind of sense of identity that I have. That's really the truest thing of me is that in fact Christ has died for me and I am a beloved child of God. Like that is that deeper reality that's hard to get to. So no doubt you can do that. I think we do that often, and there's a weird tension between commitment to disciplines and also encountering communion with God that you have to kind of constantly balance.
You know, I guess talk with people that like come to church for the first time in a long time. And they have kind of this like shameful. They're like, you know, I
haven't been hit by lightning if I walk through those doors.
Yeah, they'll be like, I mean, I watched online a little bit, but you know, I really haven't been here, and they're really apologetic, and it's like, hey, breathe easy, you know? Like,
we're glad you're here.
Yeah.
We're figuring this stuff out. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why I like how we've been talking about the disciplines as like a way of surrendering or submitting to the Holy Spirit, because I think you could either see it as surrendering or as like self-righteousness in a way.
Yeah.
So you could approach disciplines in two ways or in multiple ways, and it could lean towards making religion or those practices an idol, or it could lean towards surrendering or submitting and finding our identity in Him.
Yeah.
But I haven't always approached it with the posture of surrender, but I think it helps frame it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
You brought that out well yesterday when you talked about Sabbath, saying you made a case like, look, I really believe this is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I think the practice will change your life. But if it ever distracted you from Jesus, I would say stop doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's Paul's like beautiful phrase there, where he's looking at people who, and again, think of the role of circumcision. It was a religious practice that was being used to say you are excluded from the way of Jesus. And Paul's like, you've missed that's a shadow of a deeper reality, which I think is a really important phrase to understand. because that is ultimately all of the disciplines that we're talking about, Rachel, is I love the way you worded that, of like, it is a yielding or a surrendering to the Holy Spirit. Is it's simply it's a tool, it's a mechanism, it's not the end goal. And when we make them the end goal, then we've gone off the rails. But rather, like, if someone says, hey, Sabbath is untenable in my life, I have no problem. Like, that, there is not required anywhere. It is not a sin to not Sabbath. The follow-up question, though, is, but how can you, with the life that God's given you, organize your days so you can become aware of God's presence and commune with Him? Sabbath is one of the ways that throughout church history we've done, but it's not the only way. And but it doesn't also skirt that we to be a disciple of Jesus, to follow Him, you have to grow in communion with Him. There is that sense of how do I organize my life in such a way that yields or surrenders myself to Jesus in all aspects of life. So you have to, that's the tension, right? Is it's not necessarily that, but here's some time-tested tools that seem to open us up to that. But they're a shadow of the greater reality, which is Christ. And that the experience of communion with Christ is what we're after.
And I think the emphasis on Sabbath and silence and solitude and all these other practices we're going over not being necessary or requirements.
Yeah.
Was huge, because they can so easily become more works.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I've tried everything else that I can do, but I haven't tried forcing myself into a weekly Sabbath rhythm or forcing myself into silence and solitude. Yeah. Surely those are the magic key to a that'll perfect spiritual life.
Yeah,
yeah. And then it just becomes another work that we're trying to do, which is not its intended purpose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And every generation that's followed Jesus has to figure out how to do it with their own unique complexities of life. And that's why so much of what we're talking about, I mean, if you really look at the first 2 years of our rule of life around practices of presence, the reason we pick things like Sabbath or silence and those sorts of things that I really deeply believe in is because we in the modern age have a unique problem of pace of life and speed. And our life is going so quickly that I just think we move too fast to even encounter God. And so there's a uniqueness to these that, yes, throughout history they've used, but I think they become more vital in the modern age because of the water we swim in is moving at a pace that we are quite literally too busy to follow Jesus. So there's a uniqueness to that.
That tension is the root of an interesting subculture. The motto is reject modernity, embrace tradition. I've seen it in all sorts of contexts, from pure irony to extremism almost.
Is that why you wear vintage cashmere sweaters?
No.
Freshly ironed?
Nah. He means nah.
Steamed. Hand-stitched.
But I do find myself wondering, was it in some ways done better in the past? And the pull is not to try and find a new way to make it work where we're at, but to run away backwards and hope that we get back to some better
pace
of an orientation of life.
Yeah.
I was watching Tom and Jerry a couple nights ago. I promise this is relevant.
The cartoon?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Like the,
where do you watch that?
HBO, baby. All three Tom seasons and Jerry of the cartoon HBO on now. HBO.
What does the world come to?
We're going back.
And there's a scene where it's a beautiful day out. Tom decides he's going to sunbathe, read a book, listen to the radio, sip on a lemonade. And this is back in the day when they would have had big old radios you'd carry around like a briefcase.
Yeah.
And stupid striped hammocks in their backyards. And part of me was like, that's what people used to do when they were bored, because they didn't have a phone to dive into and they didn't have a bunch of emails to distract them. That's in many ways living in the moment. But I don't think the answer is to go back to the 40s and 50s.
Yeah,
it's to instead find space.
Golden age, yeah.
Yeah.
Which one was the mouse?
Jerry.
Jerry.
How do we know that? They didn't like Tomcat.
And they reference it explicitly in a few episodes.
Okay.
Jerry Mouse and Tomcat.
Yeah, yeah.
Where was Jerry during all of this? It feels like he would have been causing
chaos. He stole untying the hammock.
So Kevin, Paul in this, you kind of brought out three things that he outlines regarding apprenticeship, the being rooted and built up, being strengthened in faith, overflowing with thankfulness. But you kind of nuanced faith a little bit there when you said strengthened in faith. And I feel like maybe you brought out a different definition of faith, or a more nuanced definition of faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of start with saying that we think, and I think I actually a few minutes ago said it, but we think of faith often as this sort of blind leap, like this sense of just like, I'm just going to believe whatever and jump and assume. And so it becomes this game of like, to increase or to be strengthened in faith is to just believe so much that you can check out everything else.
And there are theologies
built around that,
right?
Yeah.
Like there's probably been a lot of people, I know I've been at churches that kind of, you haven't arrived to a certain level of faith if certain things don't happen
in your life. Yeah. So therefore you just got to believe harder or whatnot. but this word in Greek, pistis, is almost, so just highlight that, almost always you can translate it as like also faithfulness, which I think is a better, it's moving towards that concept that I used on Sunday of trust or allegiance. Because if it's just faith, we think of it as a static thing that you possess or don't possess. But this idea of faithfulness carries with it, again, one of my favorite lines I quoted 2 weeks ago was that long obedience in the same direction, a sort of ongoing understanding of like a trajectory of life towards something. That's why I like that idea of allegiance a lot, because I think allegiance gives a little bit of space for doubt and questioning. I believe what happened with my unbelief, right? That scene in the Gospels where the guy goes up to Jesus and confesses that. And so it becomes something different than just the sort of like blind, I'm going to believe Jesus will do these sorts of things. And it becomes a little bit more in the relational context too, of like, I'm placing my allegiance in Jesus. It means I'm following regardless of kind of what takes place next.
Yeah.
And so faith to me that is more, it places it in a bit more of an active thing. And so then to be strengthened in faith is less, I'm going to believe at the expense of whatever else is presented to me, and more of like, I'm growing in allegiance to Christ. Like when you phrase it that way, that becomes to me a totally different thing where now it's like, okay, I'm going to follow the Lord, whether or not that thing I want to happen happens, or whether I face this kind of persecution or challenge or doubt or whatever it is. It's that, man, Jesus is in fact Lord. And to be strengthened in that reality is like, I'm going to roll through life with him, whatever comes my way, you know, because I then have that sort of growing allegiance in Jesus.
I love that. I love that because if you think about like faith, we have this way of making our faith fit into every little piece of our life and to coexist with even some of the unhealthy things in our life. When you use it in terms of allegiance, now you're talking about addressing conflicting. You can't.
Yeah.
When you talk about allegiance, you can't be allegiant to one thing. Allegiant? Mm-hmm. Is that how you say it?
Can't have your allegiance.
Can't have it. Allegiance an airline.
Legion, yes, it's like an airline or a bank or something.
But like there are things that like you can't have an allegiance in this thing and also have an allegiance to like another. Yeah, yeah. Like it's one. Yeah.
Yeah. Or there at minimum has to be a hierarchy of allegiances. Like I think you could technically have secondary allegiances, but it's going to. Like there has to be a hierarchy. Like my highest allegiance to Jesus, but I feel like I do have an allegiance in some ways, and it's weird language to use with like Lindsay and my marriage. But there is like that's an allegiance, but it is subservient to my ultimate allegiance to the Lord. For instance, maybe a good example is like we have an allegiance to Jesus, and we say a pledge of allegiance. We should wrestle with that. To pledge allegiance to even to our country, I think is a good thing. But we should, as Christians, wrestle with that because there will be times in which our allegiances conflict.
Yeah.
So what do we do when our allegiances conflict? And that becomes a really complicated issue. And in some ways, that's what Paul was wrestling with here. Is like, for those Jews, they had an allegiance to Judaism, but they also had an allegiance to the Lord. Like, what do you do when those conflict? What do we do when our allegiances conflict? And so there's a more relational bent towards that understanding.
I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. Which a great book on that. If anyone's wanting more of that, I think I referenced Matthew Bates. Let me look it up. Yeah. He has a book called Salvation by Allegiance Alone, which he's playing off that, idea of salvation by faith alone, which is really an interesting perspective. Then when you think of that particular concept or theological doctrine of like, you're saved through your allegiance to Christ. Some ways that's different than again this sort of blind belief of like I believe it's in that vein, but it's like no, I'm placing my allegiance to follow Jesus, my faithfulness to Jesus. So anyway, it's a great book, Salvation by Allegiance Alone.
Let's go to your Willard quote. It's not about going to heaven when you die. I gotta imagine this is a little controversial because chat about that. What is the quote? And
yeah, I was actually, so that quote came to me in the middle of the sermon. So I was actually just trying to look it up and see if I actually quoted it somewhere.
You just had it memorized?
Yeah, that's one of those that stuck with me. It's a good one.
So that you'll memorize, but you won't memorize your bank routing number. Sorry, listener. We were talking about memorizing numbers earlier and Kevin was against it.
Yeah.
For context, we all were.
Yeah,
except for you, Brandon.
Which the only argument against it I can imagine is that your hard drive is full and you're worried about filling it with more stuff. I don't know. why not memorize numbers? Anyway, continue.
I can't find the direct quote, and so I might be butchering Willard's actual words, but it was something to the effect of, again, like salvation isn't about, or the gospel isn't about going to heaven when you die, but it's about getting heaven into you before you die. Like, and there's that distinction. What Willard's making is actually a really important point about what we understand about the gospel. Most of us have a reduced view that it's solely about going to heaven when we die, opposed to language I'm a little more comfortable with that I think the New Testament speaks much more to, is the idea of the kingdom of heaven and entering into the kingdom of heaven. And that is and heaven... There's a whole lot to like unpack here, but like that concept of heaven is we think of it as a place somewhere else. And I think that's a wrong way to think of it. I think it's better to understand it as a sort of dimension that we live into. So when Jesus comes and says the kingdom of heaven is here, that's really important because he's not talking about there or elsewhere, but he's saying it's available right here, right now. And you can step into that reality now. And so we often think like, there's another little quip that Willard has. This one I should look up because it's really good. we focus so much on the question, like, do you know where you'll go when you die? Right? Like that's like a classic event, evangelistic question that I think is really a poor one. But another way to like that he always says is like, but what happens if you live? Do you know what you're going to do if you live? Like Jesus is very much interested in this very life. And we have a way of speaking of the gospel and what Jesus is doing about some sort of eternal reality, which, of course, that is true. It's not that that's wrong. But Jesus is also very much interested in the kingdom of heaven here and now. And discipleship is about living in light of that reality. And this is a much larger kind of concept. We'll talk a little bit about it this coming Sunday, about, again, Paul's understanding of old creation and new creation. We've talked a good amount on the podcast about this, but the idea is that new creation, which is the kingdom of heaven, remaking this very world, this material world, is entering into the story. It's breaking in right now. That's what Jesus is announcing. The kingdom of heaven is here. That new creation reality is here, which means then this old creation of that's governed by sin and death and brokenness, that's dying. That's passing away. So Paul says in his understanding of the gospel is that these two creations coexist, and we then as Christians are living into the new creation right in the midst of the old creation. And so it's that idea then means when we live by the power of the gospel, we're living into the reality of the new creation. Things like the first are last, things like it's better to give than to receive. Like all of those things are new creation realities that go against the common sense belief or old creation dynamics, which is why they're painful and difficult, because we live in a created order that is governed or broken by sin. And so those things, those realities contrast with the world around us. This is the competing myths. This is why we run to accomplishment and say, this is where I find my identity, because that is how you find your identity in the old creation, in the thing that's dying away. But in the new creation, that reality that's coming, you aren't what you accomplish. You are who God says you are, which is that reality of, again, a beloved child, son or daughter of God that is embraced as you are, not as you think you should be. Like that is a reality. Like we have to get to that level to see it, not as something we hope for and wish for. No, it is the truth about the universe right now. Like to say Jesus is Lord over creation means that those things he taught are in fact true. This is the importance of something like the Sermon on the Mount, which at some point we're going to spend some time in the Sermon on the Mount. I think it's so important because that's Jesus' sort of manifesto of how to live into the kingdom here and now. So when he says something like, love your enemies, he's not just saying, I hope you do that. He's saying that's how the real world operates. To hate your enemy is an old creation reality that isn't actually, it's dying off. It's not the way to live anymore. And in chapter 3 of Colossians that this Sunday we'll look at, Paul's saying, here's how you then live. Since you have died and your life is hidden in Christ, put to death all that corresponds to the old creation dynamics so that you can live more into the reality that's breaking in, that new creation. That was a bit preachy. I can't remember how we got there. But that, like, to me, that is the broad story of what we're doing, like what the gospel is announcing, is that new creation's here, Jesus is Lord, and he has died and created a way in which you can overcome that alienation and live into that new reality here and now. And that life extends from this moment through eternity. I'll pause there.
I feel like we need to sing a worship song right now. Rachel, get that guitar off the wall. No, that's really good, Kevin. And
one more thought that I think I'm hanging on and I'm preaching a little bit too much.
You're overtime already.
I'm overtime already. Yeah, that never stopped me.
No, go ahead.
But it's like, think of the logic of that as well, is if we are governed by old creation and new creation is pressing in more and more and more, you are not, if you're governed by old creation, you're not the kind of person who can endure in the new creation. Because your life hasn't been renovated by the work of the Holy Spirit in a way that can actually exist in that. If the reality of loving your enemies is permeated in all, right? If Jesus is who he says, Paul says he is, first among the dead, the living and the dead, the sustainer of all creation, like if that's the reality, like oil can't sit with water, you governed by old creation can't sit with that reality. And so the more that reality comes to bear, and the more when Christ returns and the second coming and all of this is then remade and that's fully established all in all, your life just literally can't exist in that. It would be a form of hell to live in contrast to that reality. And so, of course, then your life doesn't carry on into the age to come.
Mm.
Less out of this harsh punishment, but more out of, I don't know how, like oil and water, it just conflicts. It does not mesh. But yet the work of the Holy Spirit is creating in us the kind of people who can live the eternal life now.
Heaven is hell for the old creation is, that's a bar.
That's a good line right there.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
So Kevin, on our way out of this, I'm wondering, considering the three myths that you kind of closed with,
mm-hmm.
what would be your sort of, like the moment you had with Maddie, where you said, you're brave, you know, all the stuff you said to her. What's your pastoral moment with all of us as we consider and as we go out and we try to find our identity in the right places? Given that these are our, the achievement, the possessions, our deepest failure and our greatest success are things that we tend to gravitate towards, what would be your pastoral encouragement to us?
Yeah, that's a good...
Imagine holding my face in your hands.
A giant man.
15-foot Kevin. You. Cradling Brandon.
I'll speak more from what I'm trying to learn in this. Because I feel like this is something that I've been journeying with the Lord on too. And so maybe it'll benefit. But I think it's how do we learn to be loved by God, which seems so basic, but yet like I find myself coming back more and more to trying to be comfortable sitting with God. And part of this comes back to, for me, it's in the quiet where I don't have the ability to pretend. I don't have, like when I'm in the quiet with God, I can't fake it anymore. You know, I can't project an image that's better than I am. I can't lean on my accomplishments, my accumulations, my failure successes. Like I can't lean on those to find any other thing other than just sitting before and allowing me to allow God to love me and for me to experience that love. And that tends to grow from a posture of just being comfortable with who I am before God and more seeing him as a God who does look at me as the beloved. And I'm not there. I mean, I wrestle with that. I don't know if I've gotten that at the core of my being. I think I know it intellectually and I'm trying to move it more towards a lived reality, but I don't know. I think it's as simple as that, is how do we learn to see ourselves as the beloved of God?